You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
It's lovely seeing all of you here. Thank you so much for coming along. I am so excited to be here this morning launching my new book. This is a big moment for me, and it actually feels like full circle because I was here speaking in this very venue a couple of years ago on along the themes of this book, and that was towards the beginning of me trying to put my thoughts down into some kind of content. And I was trying things out, seeing how they resonated with people, taking feedback. I remember chatting with folks afterwards and at various other talks as well, and thinking it through and refining. So if you were here a couple of years ago, some of what you hear this morning will sound familiar, but a lot of it won't, because of course it's moved on and it's developed since then and it's changed. At the end of the book, and I ought to say, in case you don't realise, I'm here to talk about my book, How to Survive a World in Crisis, and then very importantly in brackets, and not grow weary of doing good, which for me is the absolute key bit of the title. At the end of the book, I say that me writing it has been an act of bravery. And it was, because I have had this, the themes of this book, and this book has been growing in me for quite a number of years. And then various life events kind of knocked all of my self-confidence out. And I had quite a while where I knew I wanted to write this book. I knew I had these themes in here. And I was speaking about the themes, but it's quite different to talk about the themes in half an hour to writing a whole book about them. And I got myself into a place where I convinced myself that I couldn't do it, and that I couldn't write it, and that even if I did write it, nobody would be interested in what I had to say, and no one would want to read it. And so I got myself into this cycle, and I thought, how can I break myself out of this? I could feel this book growing in me, but I just didn't have the confidence to do it. And I thought, okay, the first thing that I could do, my first step of bravery, is to contact the editor of my other books, Alison, who's sitting here this morning, and to say, I've got an idea for the book. Could we meet up and just have a chat and you tell me what you think? So we met up and we talked it through. Alison thought it sounded a great idea, and I came with all the blockages. I knew all the blockages that I had in me as to what was stopping me from writing, and she was great. She gave me one or two little keys, said, go away and try this, and what she said unlocked it. And I was going for a walk one day, as I do most days. I do my best thinking. I'm sure it's the same for many of you here, having brooded on this for years. I went for a walk, and just out of nowhere, the first line and the first story came into my mind, and I thought, right, I'm going to start writing when I get home. So I got home, wrote that down, started writing, and before I knew it, I had the introduction done. And then every chapter, I sat down at the start of every chapter saying to myself, I can't do it, I don't know what I'm going to write, don't know how I'm going to do this. And then once I got going, it all came out. And I'm saying that really because I want to encourage you also to be taking little and big acts of bravery. There may be things that you are sitting on, that you want to do, that you wish you could get involved with, that you're not quite sure, you know, what about me? Does anybody care? Is there a point? I just want to encourage you, take the first step, whatever that act of bravery might look like in your life, and then see where it leads you to. And I want to thank you, because my session here a couple of years ago was part of the process of me working through my lack of confidence and getting feedback from people and then refining it on from there. So thank you, Greenbelt, and for all of you who were here then and chatted with me and just encouraged me by turning up. Thank you for the part that you have played in bringing together this book. which has come from decades of working for social justice and environmental care, particularly in the area, of course, of the climate crisis. I know a number of you here know me from that perspective. From speaking, talking, writing for decades, and most importantly, trying to be actively living it out. And one of the questions that I get asked most as I travel around and speak is, how do you keep going? You know, I'm getting a bit long in the tooth now. I'm not a young activist like I was some decades ago, but here I still am. And people ask me, how do you keep going? And in the midst of what feels like relentlessly bad news. And it's been a really good question that I've started to think through. It's made me think through, what actually have I had in place? It's not because I'm an amazing person, it's because I've had some good things in place that have enabled me to do that, to keep going. And this book has also come from the realization that as I have walked this journey over the years, I have had traveling companions, some of whom have stayed with me for the course, others of whom haven't, with no sense of condemnation or guilt. It's been too much for them. They haven't been able to stay the course. They have been overwhelmed and burnt out. And I've thought through what might be helpful to help people not get to that place. And the book has also come from the realization that I know will reflect all of us here, that we have moved from prediction to reality, particularly thinking about the climate crisis. I've spent many, many years effectively saying there's a crisis coming. This is why, as Christians, we need to be involved. This is how you can take action. If we take action, we'll stop the crisis. Well, of course, we haven't. And some years ago, as I was looking down through the media headlines, it just hit me. Oh, my goodness. I could see all the media headlines. There was talking about heat waves and droughts and coral reef bleaching and hunger and extreme weather events. And I read through it all and I thought, my goodness, we have tipped over. We're not in predictions anymore. We're in reality. All the things that scientists have been predicting for so many years are here now. So actually, what do we do with that? How do we respond to that? And it's not only about the climate crisis, of course. I know all of you here will be coming with your own passions, your own burdens, your own cares. And it may be that they have got better. I would hazard a guess they may well not have done. And how do we deal with that? How do we cope with that? And so again, this book has come from me thinking through, really for myself, how do I deal with the fact that we are in a climate crisis? And not just throw my hands up and say, oh, well, it's all too late. We didn't take action, so I'm going to give up. Or to say, it's all too much. I'm going to spend the rest of my life hidden under a duvet. I can't face the world anymore. Because we know that we can't be like that, can we? We know that we have to keep acting in whatever area it is that we're involved with. We know that we can't give up. We have to keep going. So how do we do that? And these questions have become even more relevant for me as over the last couple of years I've got increasingly involved in the Middle East through my work with Embrace the Middle East, and particularly with Palestine, with the area that we might call the Holy Land. And I want to recognize that some of you here have been active in this area and around these issues for many years and many more years than I have been. And I just want to pay respect to you for that, because I know that I'm late to this because my focus has been elsewhere. But I know that this is a heartbreaking area of the world to be involved with. It's a heartbreaking set of issues. It makes me very angry. It quite often makes me cry. And it can take a real toll on our mental health to be involved with this area day in, day out. I'm very aware for my team just the news every day is so relentlessly awful. So how do we survive in this world of crises and not give up doing good? And you will have, as I say, your own particular passion and area. So this book is relevant really for anybody who wants to not grow weary of doing good in whatever way it might be. And I just want to read out a bit of the introduction as before I move into the main points. We live on an amazingly beautiful planet full of amazingly beautiful people and creatures. And I hope it's obvious that the last thing the world needs is for us to give up in the face of the deep and worrying challenges we face. But how can we keep going in ways that don't put too much pressure on us, that don't overwhelm us and lead us to burnout? How can we harness our passion, our grief, and our anger to help us in ways that mean they don't flare up for a short time and then fizzle out as everyday pressures dose the flames? How do we sustain that light that we carry through all the years and decades of our lives? How can we bring hope into the different areas of darkness that we're each called to enter? How do we heed the words of Galatians 6, not to become weary of doing good? And so that's what this book is about. And there are 7 chapters to it that I'm just going to introduce you to. Really tools that I have found that have helped me over the decades, and I'm sure you would be able to speak into those as well, because I know I'm looking out over a wonderful sea of faces of people who have been doing good for many, many years. The first chapter is called Hold On To Your Vision. We live in a consumer age. We live in an age that teaches us short-termism. It teaches us not to keep our attention on something for very long. It teaches us just to be interested for a little while and then to move on. I've been involved for many years in my local community association. I live on what would have been called a social housing estate and have been involved there with a fabulous group of people for a good number of years. And there's a core of us who stayed faithful and active all the way through. But I noticed that people would come in and they would go, and people tended to have an active span of maybe about 18 months to 2 years. And then their interests would go elsewhere and they would move on. In one sense, that's okay. We're going to, you know, life circumstances are going to mean that happens. But I want to encourage you to hold on to the vision that you've got. We need people with a vision at this time. Whatever it might be, whatever that area is, that concern that is in your heart, maybe you could just name it to yourself. It doesn't have to be some great big grand vision, but just what is that area of concern that you know that you feel particularly? And talking about a vision can sound very grand scale, but actually it translates into just showing up for things every day, showing up for that vision day in, day out, turning up to meetings, writing emails, doing whatever it is that it takes, digging in for the long haul, making everyday decisions, being reliable. Having big visions and seeing them through actually is quite boring, and part of staying for the long haul is not minding when it gets boring. And in this chapter, I look at how can we carry a vision, but in a light way that doesn't topple us over. I recognize that circumstances will change. You know, I'm not doing the same thing now that I was doing 10 years ago. And that's okay. But my overall vision around the kingdom of God, around social justice, around the flourishing of people and of natural places, my overall vision stays the same. That's what keeps me true. But then it might outwork itself in different ways over time. And that's just part of growth, isn't it? And something for us to embrace wherever God places us. And we root our individual visions in the big vision of God and of God's kingdom. And for me, that is how we keep hold of the visions, the individual visions that we all carry, that overarching narrative that we see in the scriptures around God's heart for those who are living in poverty, God's heart for the dispossessed, God's heart for us to challenge injustice, God's heart for the flourishing of the whole natural world. I look at the theologies around Jubilee, I look at the kingdom, I look at Jesus in this chapter and say, let's make sure that our individual visions are rooted in that wide vision of the kingdom of God. And then secondly, acknowledge your pain. One of my colleagues and friends who is here in this tent, so I won't embarrass him, we were chatting some while ago, and he is a long-time humanitarian worker, has lived and served in some of the hardest places in the world. And just not so long ago, we were chatting about a particularly heartbreaking situation that we are involved with through our work. And he just said, you know, I don't think I've ever really felt or maybe acknowledged a deep anger like this. It's rocking me to the core. And I want to say, when we look at the crises that we face in our world, we need to face them full on, head on. We need to look at them and we need to acknowledge how they make us feel. Again, we're taught in our consumer-driven culture just to kind of make ourselves immune to these things. You know, if something's upsetting, it's fine. We'll just scroll through it, turn off the news, scroll through social media, do something, distract ourselves with some reality TV program. You know, we're in this culture of the entertainment industry that doesn't want us to see what is going on. And sometimes it is good for us to acknowledge how it makes us feel. When I drove up yesterday morning and I was listening to the radio, and the whole way up, I live down in the south of England, the whole way up I was listening either to Radio 4 or the World Service, and they had a whole load of different science programmes. But the science programmes, whatever they started off looking at, in the end came back to looking either at climate or at some environmental problem. And I was listening to this all the way up until at one point, in the middle of driving, I burst into tears. And I said to myself, Ruth, practice what you preach. Turn this off. This isn't now doing you any good. And I needed to acknowledge that what I was listening to actually was really upsetting. You know, these aren't just theoretical things. We need to look these things in the face. Sometimes we can't live in those places, but we need to have moments where we acknowledge actually how we feel about what's going on. I've realized I've been dealing with a lot of anger this summer. I feel really angry about the heat waves that we've been going through, because it didn't need to be like this. If we'd all, and of course governments and businesses particularly, if we'd listened and acted, we would not be in this situation. And I am so angry that this is where we are now. And I've been kind of working that through and acknowledging to myself that that is how we feel. And it's recognizing too that where you have a soft heart, where you care about things, that will take you into some levels of trauma. It might not be the same as the trauma of those who are directly impacted, though of course I know here we will have many people who are directly impacted by different things. But trauma, whether immediate or vicarious, is very real, and we need to recognize that. I came to the realization not too long ago that I think I probably live with a kind of mild level of trauma just constantly. And so I have to be really aware of that and make sure that I'm looking after myself. And you know, we have those trauma responses of fight or freeze or flee, and there's a new one that's come in about fawn, and you can look up as to what that means. But I've been thinking through, actually, how can we turn those trauma responses into, how can we channel those into things that are good? And let me just read out one paragraph. In many ways, this book is about how, rather than denying the trauma and the trauma responses that get triggered in us, it's about how we turn those four responses into positive action for our world. So instead of fighting and kicking out with aggression, we can become strong leaders who refuse to accept the injustices of our day. Instead of fleeing the problems by denial and disengagement, we can learn what boundaries we need in place to ensure that the problems don't overwhelm us and what is healthy or not for us to engage in. Instead of freezing in a way that leads to paralysis and inaction, we can instead learn practices of stillness and silence that enable us to process the heartache and keep engaging positively. And instead of fawning to the aggressors and the oppressors, we can learn to use our empathy to speak up for the abused and the downtrodden. So we recognize our trauma and the pain that we carry, and we turn that into something positive, and we turn that into lament. I know we hear a lot about lament today, and I want to encourage you to find your own ways to lament, because lament is courage. Lament says that we will not look away and ignore. Lament rises from love and compassion and says that we care. Lament is an act of protest against the sadnesses of this world. It's an act of protest against the migrants taking terrible risks to reach safety. It's a protest against the fracturing and the loneliness in our societies, against the rising tide of mental health problems, against the increasing need for food banks. It's a protest against racism and an aggressive nationalism. And lament we turn into prayer. Lament isn't simply just blind rage like I've been experiencing, or tearful words flung randomly out. In lament, we bring our griefs to the divine like incense rising. So lament in itself is a form of hope. It says we will not give up, and we will not, but we will keep taking action. And of course, we have in our scriptures, particularly in the Psalms, many, many resources for lament. So then thirdly, find your community. Last year, I did a climate retreat at St. Catherine's Retreat Centre. Some of you will know that in the East End of London. And I'd carefully crafted this day where I had some input, you know, different sessions, some input from me that I would do at the beginning. And then I would send them off into quietness and stillness to journal, to think, to pray, to have that retreat from the stresses that they were carrying. And there were about 30 of us in the room. So we started off by going round. I just asked them to say, who were they and why were they here? And people talked very briefly, but they talked about their sense of loneliness, their discouragement, how they just felt they were taking action on their own, their church didn't care, their family didn't understand. And then people started talking about the different things that they were doing to respond. And before I knew it, there was this whole conversation going. And when I got to the last person, he said, why? He said, I came here on my own. He said, but I feel so encouraged just hearing, knowing that other people feel like me and to hear about the different things that you're all doing. And I thought, that's great. I haven't even started and my job is done. And then throughout the day, I had real trouble getting them actually to do what I wanted them to do. You know, I would do my little talk and then my carefully crafted exercises, and I would send them off to go around the lovely gardens on their own and to pray and to reflect. Darn things, I couldn't get them out of the room. So they were all chatting. And when I looked at them and as they had gone, they were all sitting in pairs or in threes under the trees or on the benches having a conversation. Coffee times and meal times. I couldn't get them back into the room for the session. I felt like, you know, a teacher with naughty school children not doing what I was asking them to do. And I was getting quite frustrated until, of course, you know, the light bulb came on and I thought, you stupid. Of course, this is what's happening. They're finding community. They don't want to be on their own in quiet, silent retreat because that's how they feel they are all the time. They want to be together. And through the day, actually, a really beautiful thing happened as they connected and they found each other and realized that they weren't on their own. And a sense of community is such an important tool in helping us to keep doing good. It's so basic. Whatever area it is that we are involved with, just having people around us, study after study, and in fact, we don't really need studies, do we, to show us the negative impacts on our physical and mental state when we are lonely, when we feel overwhelmed. And then conversely, how sharing and being with others can help us feel less overwhelmed and can lead also to new perspectives and to new insights as we talk with each other. From a Christian perspective, this isn't surprising. Christian and Jewish tradition teaches that we have been created in the image of God. And when we look at who God is, we know that fundamentally God is relationship. God is Trinity. God is not aloneness. And so we are to reflect. We reflect that reality. To be human is to be in relationship. The Eastern Orthodox theologian John Zizioulas used to talk about people as beings in communion. What a beautiful expression. So being in communion is crucial to our wholeness as human beings. And being in community is a crucial place for us to be, for us to learn from each other. I know that I am who I am because of other people, some of whom, thank you, are sitting in this room. I know that I am a better person. I know that I do more because I see other people by in conversation or seeing some of you here on social media and seeing the things that you're doing and the steps that you're taking makes me think, oh yeah, I could do that too. What an encouragement. So we learn and we get encouraged by other people. And perhaps one of the biggest impacts of community is the impact that we have when we act together. I do believe all the little individual things that we do add up and make a difference, but I firmly believe that together we are strong and we are powerful and we can be a movement for change. It's been my privilege, as I know it has for others of us here, to be involved in a number of movements over the years that have resulted in changes happening at governmental or business level. And they have come about because of all sorts of communities of people coordinating and acting together, often working together for many years. These things don't happen overnight. Refusing to be silent or to take no for an answer. And for many of us here, our basic community is the church. I know that's a sensitive topic. I know that church can be a place of hurt, can be a place of abuse. It can be a place sometimes that increases our sense of loneliness and of not being understood. And yet, church, both local and the worldwide body of Christ, is and could be and should be our fundamental, our kind of base community, our ecclesial community. And I encourage you not to give up on church and not to give up on being part of a church community, however that might look to you. So then fourthly, how do we keep on doing good in this world? Well, by taking action. Now that might sound a bit tautologous. How do we keep taking action? We keep taking action by taking action. That doesn't really make sense, does it? But psychologists, when you look at the psychology, particularly around climate grief and anxiety, all agree that one of the most powerful things we can do is just to do something. To get out from under our duvets, and that might take community to enable that to happen, and to do something, however small or however big. And when we do that, then we begin to take a sense of ownership and a sense of power into our hands. This is chapter four in here. I don't go through all the different things that we can do to take action. So it's not a list of action points, because, you know, I've written on that many times over the years. You can see some of my books. I know they've got L is for Lifestyle is over on the bookstand as well, and that looks at the detail of the kind of ways that we can take action. So I don't go over that again in this chapter. More, I'm looking at why do we keep taking action, and how can we keep doing that positively. So why we keep taking action for me is twofold. One, because very basically, as a person of faith, for those of us here who are Christians, it is part of our discipleship and worship. Whether we make a difference, whether whatever, I do this because I'm a Christian. And I do this because it's the right thing for me to do as a Christian. It is part of my fundamental understanding of who the God is who I worship, and therefore what it means to be following that God and living out a life of discipleship and worship. So that for me is the absolute fundamental that I come back to time and time again. Whatever the impact, we just do this because it's the right thing to do. And we keep taking action because we simply don't know. We don't know what the future holds. We don't know what's going to happen. Things might look bleak, but we don't know. There's all sorts of scientific, sociological, anthropological research into what brings about tipping points, and I'm not going to go into the complexities of that here. In the end, nobody really knows, but tipping points happen, don't they? You look back at the civil rights movements, the suffragettes, you know, we can go through so many things in history. A lot of pain has to be gone through, but finally, something clicks and something tips over, and we can be a part of that. If we stop taking action, those tipping points will never be reached, but they can be, they will be, they might be. And so that is also why I keep acting and keep going, because I just don't know what tomorrow holds, and because I am part of community, because the media might want to sell me a whole load of lines. But actually, when I come somewhere like here, when I meet friends in person or online, I know that there are millions and millions and millions of us out there doing good. We are not on our own. The majority of people in the UK care about climate and want to see action on that. Don't listen to what our politicians and what most of the media tells us, and don't think that that is what most people think, because it isn't. The vast majority of people, some 70% or so in the UK, care about the climate and want to see action. So there's a lot of latent care out there for us to harness, and that will be the same in many of the other issues that we are involved with, representing through this room. So we keep taking action. And how do we do that? Well, we do it with humility, knowing that we will get things wrong. We focus on what is in our power to change, and don't obsess too much on what isn't in your power to change. Know your skills and focus on those. Don't worry that you're not perfect. You could come to my house and spend half an hour there, and it wouldn't take you long to see that I am not perfect at all in the way that I live. And that's fine. Don't worry that you're not perfect. Focus on what you can do. don't be put off by the detractors, particularly in our social media age, where we have so many people wanting to say something different and argue against us. Well, they can do that. That's fine. But don't let yourself be put off by them. Hold on. Coming back to point number one, hold on to your vision. And then know when you need a break. Which takes us to point number five, which is around remember the Sabbath. And this chapter is simply about knowing that we are creaturely beings and knowing that we need to take a break. Knowing that it's good for us to turn off the radio or the news or social media sometimes. Knowing that we need to build rhythms, good rhythms in our lives. We need to go on holiday. We need to have times off. We need to get together with friends and have a laugh and drink and eat nice food and tell each other funny stories. We need to watch box sets. We need to lie in late in the mornings. You know, we need to do all of those things for our sakes. Walter Brueggemann said, Sabbath is a pause that permits us to reflect who we are created to be, who we are called to be. And it makes us aware the extent to which we have forgotten our creaturely reality. We are creatures with very physical needs. And if we just keep going and don't allow ourselves to stop, if we feel guilty when we stop, then we will never make it for the long haul. I know all of us here carry such burdens. The pressures of the world can weigh heavily on us. You know, we know the task is huge. The issues can't wait. We're going downhill rapidly. With every passing day, more people are pushed into poverty. More people come over the channel in boats. More greenhouse gases are released and plastic is produced. More settlers move into the West Bank. More violence happens. More people are on the search for food in food banks. More trees are cut down. You know, how on earth can we stop when there are all these things happening? But actually, I just kind of want to give you permission that you can, and the fact that you're here means that you do, because Greenbelt is a bit of a pause and a stop and something fun, isn't it? And a good way to feed ourselves. So we need to stop. When we slow down, our heart and our mind enters into a different place to where they are in the everyday. We open ourselves up to receive goodness, to receive encouragement, to be reminded of the purpose that we carry within us, to be reminded of the values that we hold, to have our tender inner beings replenished. And we give the divine the space to talk to us, to nudge us where needed, and to inspire us with fresh vision. So I encourage you to find ways to have those rhythms, to find ways to have fun, find ways to be creative. Something amazing happens when we are creative. Different parts of the brain, and I explore this in the book, different parts of the brain are triggered, releasing new energy, new ideas. Find ways to meet with others. Excuse me. And make sure that you look after yourself. Sleep well if you can. Eat well. Exercise. Breathe well. Meditate. All of those basic things, also vital in helping us to take care of ourselves so that we can stay active and engaged and take care of others and of the wider planet. And then finally, point six, part of how we take Sabbath and of those rhythms is about connecting with nature. And I'm very sorry for those of you who are connecting currently with nature in a way that you wish that you weren't. So I'm sorry about that. And in the book, I talk about someone called Nada, who heads up one of the organizations that we support at Embrace the Middle East. And he lives in Beit Jala, which is in the Bethlehem area. And with my colleague, I was there visiting him last year. He heads up an organisation that works providing different forms of relief and development in the West Bank and also in Gaza. In one of, you know, I don't need to tell you about what's happening in Gaza, but really in one of the most horrendous situations, and working, supporting staff there, providing medical care and other things. And we went out for lunch with him, and we were eating. We went downstairs. I pictured this sort of dark venue. There were men on the other table smoking their shisha, and we were eating our Palestinian food and chatting, talking with him, and he was telling us about the situation and what's happening. And I've got to tell you, it was a pretty depressing meal. It felt dark, it felt heavy, it just felt awful. And I said to him, how do you look after yourself? How do you keep going in the midst of all of this? And for the first time in the whole meal, he smiled. And he said, my garden. And he said, I make my morning prayer in the garden. I touch the earth and I look up and I see the glory. And then later after lunch, he took us to his garden and he showed us around. And I tell you more about it in the book, with some of the ancient olive trees from his family that are there and all of the significance there. I make my morning prayer in the garden. I touch the earth and I look up and see the glory. And for Nada and for so many others, it is that connection with nature that enables us to keep going. And I know I'm speaking for many of us here. Nature is a healer, isn't she? Nature is a comforter. We know through scientific studies the benefits on our physical and our mental well-being when we are connected with the natural world. Of course that's the case. As those of you who've heard me speak before will have heard me say many times, we are Adams from the Adamah, Adamah being the Hebrew for ground. We are earth creatures, we are earthy ones. And so when we are connected with the earth, with the ground, that impacts us. You may know there has been research recently that shows that there are microbes in the soil that when they come into contact with our fingers, those microbes trigger and release serotonin and the happy hormones inside of us. Isn't that amazing? We've known for millennia that gardening and being out in nature is good for us. And now science just catching up and is showing us actually physiologically one of the reasons why that's the case. And I explore that and more in this chapter. And part of what I look at is that I think we need to reclaim a Christian nature spirituality and move away from a fear of being connected from a faith perspective with the natural world. I was speaking at a church recently, chatting with the church leader afterwards, who after we were having lunch, and then when he was, you know, I was asking him what's he going to do afterwards, and he said he was going to go for a run in the nearby woods outside of the city where I was, and he looked at me and he said a little bit embarrassed. He said, Ruth, he said I have to admit, this is his church leader. He said, I know I shouldn't say this, but I encounter God more out in nature than I do in my church. And I said, why are you saying that in an embarrassed way? I said, you don't have to admit that. You worship the God of all creation. Of course you're going to encounter God when you are out in God's creation. Don't be embarrassed about that. Embrace it. So I want us to reclaim a Christian nature spirituality that means that we're not embarrassed when we encounter God in the natural world. So get out more, maybe not quite at this moment. Pay attention to what is there, whether through everyday connections. I make sure every day I get out into my garden. I try and go for a walk. I live in a city. I've got a canal near me. I do a very basic half-hour walk that's 10 minutes road, 10 minutes canal, 10 minutes road back again. It's not that inspiring, but the canal bit is lovely, and I look in people's gardens and try and appreciate what is there. Get out into nature in whatever way that is and talk to her. I'm discovering talking to the natural world that is around me, talking to the starlings as they sing loudly in the tree when I walk past them, talking to the different parts of the natural world that is there. Try it. It's interesting to see what happens. So let me conclude. In my conclusion, I talk about living out your values. As we consider the myriad issues that are facing our world in crisis, I'm convinced that what we need is people of character. People who carry strong values and who will live from those values in all areas of their lives. I'm not going to go into that here. You'll have to read the book to find out more about those values. But simply to ask, what kind of person do you want to be? And to let the answers to that question become a determination to live out those values in every area of your life. I want to conclude just by reading the final paragraph of the introduction to How to Survive a World in Crisis. And I've been talking in the introduction about a reflection with Embrace the Middle East that I was leading around the passage about there being a time for everything, time to mourn, and you know that one. And we'd been thinking, reflecting on what time is it now. And so I come back to the question, what time is it for you right now? And as I ask that of myself, I immediately come back, or it immediately comes back to me, that it is a time not to capitulate. I will not capitulate to the powers, both human and supernatural, that seek death and destruction. I will not capitulate to the forces of greed and individualism that want me to stop caring about the natural world and focus only on myself. I will not capitulate to the powerful interests that want me to feel hopeless and helpless and overwhelmed, and therefore stop taking any action and make me want to feel like I have no agency. I will not stop speaking up for those who have no voice and seeking ways to give them a voice. I will not stop taking action to help our natural world to flourish. I will not stop trying to live with gentleness, peace, and compassion. I will not stop following the God of justice and restoration. I will not capitulate. I will not grow weary of doing good. And I pray that something in the words of this book will encourage and enable you to do the same. Thank you. Yeah, do we have a joint vision of a reordered world? I think that's fabulous. And a fabulous task for us to be doing. And some, it brings me back to community and to church. I would love our churches to be places. And I think for many of us, we are in churches where they are places that are thinking through what does a reordered world look like and how do we work towards that. I begin to see part of the answer just in pictorial form in Revelation 21 and 22, with that restored, renewed heaven and earth, with God in their midst. There's no more suffering, there's no more death, there's no more mourning, as an M-O-U-R, mourning. There's trees, you know, there's the river of life. So I think that's a pictorial vision. And then the task for us is to think through, what does that look like in practice, knowing that it's not going to come until the fullness of time, but we have a task here to be living it out in our lives now, and how do we live and work towards that.
You spoke about how you've focused a lot on the climate crisis and then more recently on the Middle East. when there's so many things wrong with the world and also so many ways to tackle these many things, how do you work out where to focus your energy without getting overwhelmed by it all?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you. And it's something that I have wrestled with all down the years. I'm constantly asking myself, am I doing the right thing? Am I being the most effective? Should I be here? At one point as a family, we considered moving to Ethiopia into the slums, and would I be most effective there, or should I be here? You know, constantly asking that question. And also, to be honest, quite constantly criticized that I focus on this and on that and not on that. And, you know, I get picked up on social media where, you know, it's all that classic whataboutery, isn't it? Why are you're talking about this, but you haven't mentioned that. And I have simply come to my own peaceful conclusion that I am a flawed human being, and I'm not God, I cannot cope with all of the problems and the issues that are in our world. And I have to trust that God has put me where God wants me to be, and that I am doing what God wants me to be doing, and asking if there are other things, other places, other concerns, God, please put those on my heart as well. So I think it's a place of kind of peace, wrestling peace. I don't just want to talk about peace, but that we come to that, where we recognise that.
So he says, in the climate crisis, do you need ruptural change rather than gradual change? And how does your vision capture that?
We need huge change. Yeah. And I don't think I've said that this is all about little incremental steps. The reality is, for each one of us here, we have to find our place in that. And that often means finding the way that we can do that, which does sometimes work itself out in incremental steps. But society-wise, 100%, we need large-scale change. And we are in the position that we're in because we didn't grasp the nettle and we didn't make those changes 20, 30, 40 years ago when all of the scientific evidence was coming through. And of course, the longer we leave it, the bigger and more disruptive and more painful those changes are. So yeah, we need large scale change.
So can you talk a bit more about being part of a church community where perhaps you don't feel seen and recognised?
Yeah, I know for many of us that is our experience, that we are in churches where the issues that we care about don't seem to be ones that either the church leadership or the wider church care about. I've experienced that a lot through my work with Eco Church, with Arosha. I started Eco Church 10 years ago and would hear, just as I spoke, would hear time and time and time and time again, but my church just doesn't get it. And that has been my experience in my church as well over the years, where sometimes I've been laughed at by some of the people involved with my church. I am pleased to say that that has shifted for me in my church, and that is now a different experience to where it has been. But I know that for many people, it is really hard. And so I come back again to community and to finding one or two or three other people in your church who feel the same way as you do, and looking at how you can begin working on whatever issue it might be that you're thinking about when you ask the question, finding some others, because there will be people in our congregations who care, and it's finding those and acting together. But I really feel for you. I get that.
It's my huge privilege on your behalf to thank Ruth for today. You know, Keir Hardie, the first leader of the Labour Party, said that his mission was to go around stirring up divine discontent with the status quo. And I think throughout your ministry, you have done that. And you've done it today. But along with the challenge, you've offered us inspiration and encouragement and compassion, all important things and tools that we need to keep going and doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.